On the Dropbox for the class, I'm going to put up a Dropbox folder for any revisions of the first paper. Any of you want to write revisions, you should send me an email informing me that you've done it. But put it in the Dropbox. It's a nice, convenient place for me to keep everything anyway. So I won't lose track of it if it's in the Dropbox. So I'll set up a Dropbox folder called Revisions of Paper 1. If you do write a revision and put it in the Dropbox, then just send me an email so that I know it's there. And as I said, I'm happy for revisions. And they're, as long as they come in enough before, let's say a week before the second paper is due, I don't want, obviously, to get revisions of the first paper along with the second paper, just because of the workload. You know, I think you, having read your two papers of colleagues and written comments, you can appreciate the amount of time it takes to carefully go through papers and try to get constructive feedback on it. So if you are going to do a revision, you might as well do it sooner rather than later, rather than drag it on. Revisions need to be worth doing a revision, it needs to be more than just a kind of cosmetic, just cleaning up of the paper. You know, you should put some real thought into it and make it a proper revision of the paper. It's very helpful to me if, when you do a revision, if you include a little cover letter, as it were, a memo to me, saying what you did in the revision. You know, I don't usually devote quite as much time to reading the second draft as I did the first one, but it helps me, gives me some guidance to read it if you say a little bit about what you've done in the revision. I'll also put up a Dropbox for the handbooks. I mean, that's not until the end of the semester. But again, I think that's the most convenient way for me to have keep them all in one place. Any issues or questions anyone wants to raise? All right. Today is the last session that's specifically on the stage. Next week we begin the block of the course on ideology and culture. I'm going to, I think that the material today I can present, I keep saying this but not following through, I think actually this time I can present it in a compact way because the central core of Jaworski's argument has a nice, clean, logical structure and I can lay out its central elements. So I think today we will, in fact, have time to break down and reconvene for a more general discussion on all of this material. Let me just then briefly state what the puzzle is. The puzzle is, in a sense, what could be described as the surprising stability of democratic institutions under capitalist economies. If you go back 150 years ago, mid-19th century, before universal franchise really existed anywhere. It didn't exist in the United States, of course, until, well, if you want to include female suffrage, until the 20th century. But the key universalization of the franchise that matters for this purpose is universalizing the franchise across class lines. You didn't get universal franchise in the United States until the 1830s and 40s, depending on exactly the details of it. And of course, around race and gender, it wasn't until well into the 20th century. If you look at the middle of the 19th century and asked people, what do you think? If we give the working class the vote, if we have a universal franchise across class lines, what's going to happen? Well, there's a tremendous amount of apprehension, including among people who were generally pro-democracy. It's not that they were against the idea of universal franchise, but people were not convinced that it was a stable configuration, that capitalist economic organization with private ownership of the means of production of capitalist exploitation would be consistent with having this, the leadership of the state elected by a one-person, one-vote principle. Marx himself was skeptical about this. You know, the famous quote, which I give in the notes, where from his essay, Class Struggles in France, he thought this was a profoundly contradictory configuration. Universal franchise and capitalism. He says it forces the political rule of the bourgeoisie into democratic conditions, which at every moment help the hostile classes to victory and jeopardize the very foundations of bourgeois society. That's a pretty strong claim about the contradictory configuration of universal votes and private property, an economic system based on private property. He's not saying by this that inevitably it will lead to collapse or anything, you know, but he's just pointing to a deep tension within the system. By the time Lenin wrote The State and Revolution, 60 years after Marx, Lenin dismissed parliamentary democracy by calling it the best possible shell to perpetuate bourgeois rule. You know, Lenin was saying not only is it not very contradictory, it is the optimal system for stabilizing capitalism. That's a pretty sharply different view. I mean, there are people who have attempted, because they like to say everything is consistent, to show that Marx and Lenin actually agreed on this. I don't think that's right. I think in the middle of the 19th century, the expectation was universal franchise, that's a problem. It's at least a deep tension. By sometime in the course of the 20th century, left thinkers at least often argue something more along the line of Lenin, that is, that bourgeois democracy, universal franchise, actually helped to stabilize capitalist rule. The question is, how did this come to pass? How is it the case? Adam Szaworski has this very startling fact. So if you like little factoids in your quiver of facts. Here's a good factoid. There is no instance of a capitalist democracy in which the per capita income was above $6,000 a year in which the democracy has been overthrown. That is, in 100% of the cases, they've been stable in history. We have no exceptions. The figures, I think $6,000 a year was the per capita. That's in 1990 or whenever he published the article in which he makes the claim, roughly sometime in the 1990s. So if you have per capita income, meaning reasonably developed, but not super developed, just a non-poor democratic capitalism, in 100% of the cases, the democracy's been stable, hasn't been overthrown. That was in his discussion. You know, that's Szaworski's later work, after the work that we read for this, has been mostly on the question of dictatorship and democracy. And he's been concerned with the conditions for stable transition from authoritarian rule to democratic rule in less developed countries. That's been his main work in the last 15 or 20 years, I would say, since the early 90s. So bourgeois democracies are incredibly stable. The question is, how do we understand this? What are the mechanisms by which this stability is generated? Szaworski has approached this problem through what I think is an extremely interesting and carefully argued account of the logic and dilemmas of social democratic parties as they compete in the electoral arena for power. And it's an argument for why, in the end, those parties help stabilize capitalism rather than constitute a basic threat to capitalism. Behind his analysis, there is a general kind of model of the problem of voting in elections. This I discuss briefly on page 2. I'd like to just mention this, explain what's going on in this little chart, this little figure I drew, because it's quite relevant for those of you interested in political sociology and trying to sort out your own thinking about in political sociology more generally. And this has to do with the following distinction. So here's a slogan, as it were. for this point, that what we need is a theory of, that the theory of voting cannot be reduced to a theory of voters. That's the key idea. Most political science, when they study elections, reduce the problem of voting to the problem of voters. The standard way in which you explain the outcomes of elections is to ask yourself, what are the characteristics of voters that lead them to vote in particular ways? So the standard models have a vector of attributes of individuals, which can include class. Typically, they'll also include age and gender and religion. So you have a series of attributes of a voter. And from those attributes, you predict how they vote. And the central, one of the central concerns is, for example, has the strength of the class attributes predicting voting gone down or up? An argument that class politics has declined is typically an argument of the form. It used to be the case that the coefficient for being in the working class was large, and now it's small. There's been a decline in the strength of that coefficient. What that means is there's a decline in the strength of the relationship between the individual attribute, what class are you in, and the individual behavior, who do you vote for. That's the standard political science model. That's a model which explains voting by a study of voters. The central point of Szymborski's analysis is that you cannot understand voting without understanding strategies of parties. That attributes of voters never explain how people vote. In the absence of an understanding of how the strategies of parties act on those attributes. So the microprocesses by which the individual attributes turn into individual votes. It is true that individuals cast the votes. So it is a property of this particular game that it's individuals who go into the ballot box and decide who they're going to vote for. And so it seems natural that if individuals go into the ballot box, it's the attributes of individuals that explain what they do. It seems kind of trivial. Szymborski says it may seem trivial, but it's wrong. How people vote in the ballot box, depending upon how parties structure the choices that individuals face in the ballot box. And how parties shape the way individuals understand the relationship between their own conditions and how they should vote. And that's a result of the strategies of parties, not autonomously effective attributes of persons. And in particular, one of the things that Szymborski has, I think, illuminated, parties face a strategic environment in which they can attempt to mobilize voters on the basis of class or on the basis of religion or region. There's all sorts of different attributes of individuals that parties can attempt to mobilize people on the basis of. And that's a question of the strategies that parties adopt. So the strategies of parties are really operating in two ways. The strategies of parties determine what actually is on the ballot. You know, what choices do you actually face when you go into the ballot box? What's the meaning of the choices? And the strategies of parties shape the salience of the micro-level processes for the actors who are making those choices. It affects the subjectivity of the actors. Parties act on people and influence their subjectivity. And parties shape the range of alternatives that the actor, that people so formed make. And that's what this little micro-macro model is characterizing. In Szymborski's specific case, the case we're going to analyze now on social democracy, he then adds this very interesting argument that the class structure in which the parties operate shapes the possible strategies which they can adopt. That's the key idea in his analysis of social democratic voting. That the parties themselves are not free agents. It's not that parties can just decide willy-nilly what their strategies are going to be. Well, they, in a a sense, they can decide what their strategies are, but they can't decide what the effects of their strategies will be. If the effectivity of a given strategy depends upon the structure in which the parties themselves are acting, and in particular, the key argument that he will develop in his social democracy story is that the class structure in which parties operate heavily shapes what kinds of strategies will work and what kinds will not. It imposes constraints on the possibilities of success of different strategies.
Yeah, and he gives the example of Norwegian Social Democrat Party started to doctrinate the people according to socialist lines, and the government lasted 3 days.
Right. So I'll go through the steps of his argument, you know, carefully in just a moment. That's the basic overall architecture of it. This kind of this has not been, by the way, Szymborski developed this. This was a little bit of a research tradition that emerged from it. But the relentless methodological individualism of political science, in the end, has won out. And most voting studies in both political science and sociology remain resolutely attached to the individualistic model, which is that the attributes of persons explain the behavior of persons. This is, I think, a fertile field for further work. There were two master's theses in the 1980s in sociology that responded to Szymborski in interesting ways. One was by a person who then left sociology. I don't know what came of him, unfortunately. His name is Dale Harrington. He wrote a really extraordinarily interesting, never published, alas, master's thesis, because he kind of got discouraged and gave up on sociology, on populist voting in Oklahoma in the 1890s, right? In congressional elections, I think it was. Now, that seems like a really esoteric kind of topic. But here's the interesting thing about it. In some elections and in some districts, voters had two choices between Democrats and Republicans. In other districts, in other elections, they had three choices: populist, Democrats, and Republicans. So he was following up on Szymborski that the relationship between the attributes of persons and how they vote depends upon the nature of the choices they face, not merely their attributes. And he modeled this at the micro level using ecological data. You could get data on the class composition of counties, I think it was, or whatever was the relevant unit, and look at how those correlations were affected by the range of choices that were available. That's a, you know, it's a kind of neat idea. And very strong results. I can't tell you exact, and I don't remember the details of the argument. If any of you are kind of intrigued by this kind of thing, it's worthwhile to, you can get it from the library. Dale Harrington's MA thesis about 1983 or 4, something like that, on populist vote. Maybe it was a little earlier, maybe it was about 1980, on populist voting in Oklahoma. Another master's thesis of somebody who's actually become quite famous, but outside of the academy, Rui Teixeira. Some of you may know him, about him. He's a very big pollster for the Democratic Party, you know, a kind of leading light, and publishes a lot in the magazine The American Prospect. He was a PhD student here. He did his master's thesis on the Socialist Party in Milwaukee, in which won the city council election and the mayor in 1916, I think, and then lost it immediately thereafter in the post-World War I Red Scare, but the socialist mayor continued in Milwaukee until the 40s. So Milwaukee had a strong kind of socialist tradition. And he was sort of testing Szymborski's arguments for Milwaukee in his master's thesis. But his thesis actually ended up being a very sharp criticism of the arguments that we'll be looking at today. What Szymborski basically argues, if you've read the chapters, is that when socialist parties abandon a strong working class orientation, they lose working class votes, but gain middle class votes. Now that's exactly what lose a vote means, I'll explain in a moment. It's really losing it at the margins. It doesn't mean that their percentage of their vote in the working class declines, at least not immediately. What it means is that their marginal ability to attract an additional working class vote declines relative to their marginal ability to attract middle class votes. Well, what Shishera demonstrated in the Milwaukee elections was that in the 1890s, the Socialist Party was absolutely gung-ho workerist. You know, it was a steadfast revolutionary Socialist Party strictly promoting working class interests. And it was a small marginal party with 5 to 10% of the vote. And also getting very low representation in the working class itself. It was mostly, it had more middle-class voters when it was a strongly, exclusively pro-working-class party, anti-capitalist party. Then it decided in a strategic move to become a clean government party. That is, a party that would advocate for improved sewers and lighting and corruption. What came to be called sewer socialism. Sewers, you know, for waste removal. Critics called it sewer socialism because it was, or what in Brazil is rice and beans would be the equivalent metaphor, I think. You know, a socialist party that's basically concerned with delivering the goods for a popular class. Well, it turned out that as the party of reform and good government, it massively attracted working class votes. That actually its strength in the working class increased when it abandoned its workerist ideology in favor of pragmatic get the business done. And that runs against the grain of some of what Jaworski was saying. So that's Rui Teixeira's master's thesis, another thesis that came out of this. But that there's not a lot of work that's grown out of this framework. And if you find this interesting, this is certainly a line of research that could be done to see how the trajectory over time of voting is affected by the structure of choices available and the changes in the structural environment of voting rather than just the attributes of persons. Well, what's Jaworski's argument? The argument is based on the idea that when strategies are formed by collective actors, they need to be understood in terms of dilemmas. The notion of a dilemma is the fundamental big idea that's driving this. A dilemma means that when you're making a strategy, making a strategic choice about what to do, you face trade-offs. There's no strategic option that doesn't bring with it liabilities. Now, political actors don't like dilemmas. Right? Political actors, particularly ideologically driven political actors, like to think that there is some true path, there's some correct strategy, in which if you follow that strategy, it will lead you to victory, but you don't have to give up anything. The whole idea that you, particularly on the left, I think, it's a very painful idea that to pursue your goals steadfastly, you have to make compromises and give up things, that you can't have it all, that you face real trade-offs. Well, that's the point over and over that Jaworski wants to hammer. Parties face dilemmas. Painful choices of the character damned if you do and damned if you don't. Jaworski doesn't make this additional point, but I think one could perhaps think of it this way. What it means to live in a society where the capitalist system is hegemonic is that oppositional forces always face dilemmas. The damned if you do, damned if you don't condition is the condition of being a non-hegemonic force in a society. The word hegemony is one we haven't discussed yet. It's a kind of fancy Marxian type word to describe a particular condition of domination. I think one way of thinking about what's specific to a hegemonic system, as opposed to just a dominant system, is that in a hegemonic system, the opponents always face dilemmas. The opposition to a hegemonic system is a much more complicated matter because you're constantly in these damned if you do, damned if you don't choices. Dilemma, therefore, is the key. What Szaborski argues is that socialist parties face three nested dilemmas. This is a sequence. Each of these are dilemmas because you have to make a strategic choice. When you make your choice, then you immediately confront another dilemma. And if you make whatever choice you make with that second dilemma, then you face a third dilemma. These are a kind of sequence of dilemmas. And the integrative character of socialist politics under democratic bourgeois democracy, why it ends up reinforcing rather than undermining the system, comes from the way these three dilemmas shape the strategies of actors and the effects of those strategies on the reproduction of the system. So let's look at the three dilemmas. The first dilemma is the dilemma of participation. So what do you do? We're the central committee of the genuine, true socialist party. We all are serious about our anti-capitalism. It's not that some of us are secretly yearning to stabilize capitalism. We all recognize its exploitive and oppressive character. We all have great confidence that a democratic socialism is possible and would work and would improve the lives of the vast majority of people. So there's no disagreement on those fundamentals. But we have to make our strategic choices. We have to decide what we're going to do as a party. We are in an environment where workers have the vote. So it's different. These strategic choices are different if you're in a dictatorship. You know, if you're in Tsarist Russia and there's no votes, that's a different environment. You don't face the choice of how to participate in elections because there aren't elections. We happen to be in Milwaukee, right, 1890. And there is a question. So some of us say at this central committee meeting, no, let's stay away from these elections. This is just a trap. You get in the elections, you got to play by those rules of the game. You know, people are going to judge you by whether you win or lose the elections, by how many votes you get, which means you're going to be under pressure to get more votes, which means let's stay away from that. Stay out of elections. That's one option. And there were political parties on the left that opted for that option. Anarchists, typically, for example. And I mean left anarchists in this context, who shared many of the moral and visionary ideals of socialists. You know, there were differences, but I don't think at the level of values the differences were huge. They had very much the same notions of wanting a deeply democratic and egalitarian form of social organization. That would overcome the alienation and oppressions of private property in the market. That was true for revolutionary anarchists as well as socialists. So what do you do? Okay, so let's think it through. What happens if we sit on the sidelines and simply condemn elections? This is a fraud. The elections are a trap. Let's keep our politics in the form of demonstrations, disruptions, and the various kinds of actions that we can engage in mobilization that put pressure on the system. What happens if we stay on the sidelines? Well, one of the things that happens is that other parties are going to attempt to organize workers. You know, the fact that we decide not to doesn't mean that other parties won't. There'll be a range of other parties that will attempt to mobilize workers in the electoral arena. Some of them will do so on the economic interests of workers. So you'll have populist parties that will say to workers, vote for us in the election, and we're going to create unemployment insurance and get rid of the big banks or whatever. You know, the populists will have various kinds of programs. But you'll also have Catholic parties that will organize workers. They'll say, vote for us, and we'll vote for the traditional values that you all believe in because of your religious commitments. If we abstain, workers, it's not that workers are therefore not going to vote, they're just going to vote for other parties. By voting for other parties, they will be building their identities and their allegiances and coalitions around those parties' agendas, and we're in the end going to be marginalized. Because whether we like it or not, workers can get some benefits from voting for parties that win elections, because the parties they vote for will be able to deliver something to them. electoral victory, after all, is one of the ways that workers can recover some of the fruits of exploitation through the state. So capitalism is a system by which surplus is appropriated from workers. The state is a mechanism by which at least some of that surplus is used for public purposes. And if workers can get parties elected that even thinly represent them, then some of those public uses of the surplus might benefit workers. So if we sit on the sidelines, workers are going to vote for other parties, and we'll be marginalized. That's one corner of the dilemma. If we participate, then we risk being co-opted. We risk becoming part of the system rather than against the system. So we have this debate, and some people say, okay, look, we know that it's dangerous if we play by the rules of the game and enter the system, but we'll keep our ideological sensibilities clear. We're going to fight for these elections, but we will resist the co-optation. We will insist on our party platforms having a strong anti-system set of proposals. We are going to combat elections, but we're going to combat them on our terms, not the terms that are dictated by the established system. And in the end, we decide there's risks both ways, risks of marginalization, risks of co-optation. The risk of co-optation seems less serious of the two. That's the one. It's just too costly to abstain, to sit on the sidelines, or to participate in elections in a kind of phony way. You know, you can always participate in elections just for the platform, just, you know, to be able to speak, the soapbox function of elections. But we recognize that if we're going to participate in elections, we have to do so seriously. Okay, that's the first one, the dilemma of participation. Then the second dilemma comes in. Once you decide to be in an election and compete, you have to decide what your electoral strategy is going to be. How should we compete? What's going to be our strategy in these elections? So one strategy was the one that we felt comfortable with when we first decided to participate. We're going to participate, but damn it, we're not going to compromise on our principles. We're going to have a revolutionary platform that's going to condemn the system, that's going to constantly harp on the evils of capitalism, and have our socialist program of nationalization of the means of production, democratization of the economic system, and redistribution of wealth. Now that's, we're going to stick to that pro-working class worker, let's call that workerist, just to give it a label, platform. But what happens, according to Szymborski? We have this party, we start in the electoral arena, we get votes from workers, because some workers are attracted to that ideology, they understand, they have developed the right kind of class consciousness through their struggles in the workplace, through agitation by activists, through attending party schools, and so on. They agree with the platform. They vote for it. So we begin to develop a core of workers that vote for the party. But we face a very big problem, the working class. That is that the working class, at least the core of the working class, that is manual labor in the productive sectors of the economy, is not a majority of the electorate. By Szymborski's calculations of the nature of the working class, there's been no capitalist democracy in which the working class has been a majority. Or if it has, it's been a bare majority. When he defines this core working class, it's manual labor in industry. That means if we're going to actually win elections, we have to attract non-working class votes. We have to attract non-working class folks. We therefore face the second dilemma is a dilemma of maximizing the class purity of the party, that is, having the maximum possible percentage of the party's base being working class. So the extreme case would be 100% of the people who vote for the party are workers, versus maximizing the total vote. If you maximize the total vote, a smaller percentage of your voters will be workers, even though you might have a higher percentage of workers who vote for you. But a smaller percentage of your voters will be workers. And to attract these non-working class votes, you have to appeal to non-working class interests. Now, don't be the oddball person like Frederick Engels, who is a capitalist, who will vote for a revolutionary working class party, because they'll be voting against their class interests. But mostly, if you're going to attract non-working class voters, broadly, quote, middle class in some loose sense of voters with, in my terms, contradictory class interests, you're going to have to appeal to things other than the working class component of their interests. And typically that means voting, stressing things like good government, improved sanitation, better lighting, funding universities, the sorts of things that the civil service reform, the sorts of things that the Progressive Party in Wisconsin advocated at the beginning of the 20th century. So you have this choice. Do we go for a class alliance strategy where we dilute the working class base, or do we go for a pure working class strategy? The trade-off there is, if we go for the pure working class strategy, we're in the end less likely to win elections, but we retain our ideological purity. If we go for the class alliance strategy, we're more likely to win elections in the long run, but we undermine our ideological purity in order to attract non-working class voters. Here's how you should think about this question of losing working class votes. The argument is not so much that people who once voted for the party switch to some other party. That's less the issue, but rather, if you have an election every 4 years, you know, roughly 5 or 10% of the previous voters have died, right? You know, there's a natural attrition of voting support because of the demography of voting. And you're going to have a new cohort of young voters coming in who have never voted before. So the marginal question has to do with your ability, your relative ability to attract new voters compared to your ability previously to attract similar voters in the past. You know, so you're losing on the margin, as it were, your ability to recruit new working class voters to the party. Now, Szymborski argues that this trade-off, the rate of, but let's keep it simple to make the way of describing it easy. The rate at which you weaken your ability to attract working class voters as you attract non-working class voters, how sharp is that trade-off that you face, is a function of two sorts of parameters. One parameter is the nature of the class structure. So the smaller is the working class as a percentage of total voters, the more pressure you will be under to attract non-working class voters in order to increase your vote, your total vote. So part of the constraint just depends upon the distribution of people across the class structure. The other constraint, the other component of the constraint is how deep is the ideological commitment of the voters, of the working class voters who already vote for the party. So the stronger the ideological commitment of voters, the less likely that a class alliance strategy is going to provoke a reduction of your ability to attract workers. Given whatever the trade-off is because of the proportions of workers and non-workers in the population. How strong the ideological commitment of workers is to the party is itself, in Szymborski's basic view, an historical accident. Right, so there will be historical circumstances which will produce a strong culture of working class commitment to a particular party, such as, for example, after the Second World War, French workers were very strongly ideologically committed to the Communist Party. A strength that was out of line, so to speak, with what one might think of as the kind of fallback position in Europe why? Because the Communist Party had played such a crucial role in the anti-fascist resistance in Spain, in France, and had been the sort of heroes of the struggle against the Germans in ways that gave them enormous moral credibility in the working class. So workers in France continued to vote communist far longer than they would have been expected to if it hadn't been for that cultural legacy. Chamorro regards that kind of ideological strength variable as an accident of history. It's not something which a party can create through its own strategies in a systematic way. It's just that some are lucky, some are unlucky. A party is lucky if it happens to encounter historical moments where that kind of historic cultural commitment can get forged. And if it is, then it faces weaker trade-offs. It gives it more room to maneuver. So the French Communist Party, in principle, had more room to maneuver in devising alliance strategies than a party that didn't have that level of deep commitment to the party itself. Well, what does this do? On page 5, I draw a picture of how to think about the operation of this second dilemma. The second dilemma is, do we go for a pure working class party? Do we try to maximize the percentage of our vote that comes from workers, or do we try to maximize our total vote? What Chomorski argues is that these two strategies define what could be called the structural boundaries of the strategies of parties. I like to call them the Gramsci bounds. You know, that's my label, not Chomorski's, but I think it's consistent with a kind of Gramscian notion of how a hegemonic system works and what it means to have a strategy within it, within those constraints. The Gramsci bounds change over time. So on the horizontal axis, we have historical time. Elections occur in historical time. Those bounds change in historical time. They change for two reasons. One, they change because the class structure changes, so the nature of these trade-offs change. If the working class is growing in size, it means that the boundaries are becoming more favorable. If the working class is declining, it means that they're becoming less favorable. That's one aspect. And the other is the boundaries, these Gramsci bounds, could change over time because the strength of ideological commitment could change over time. In Chomorski's actual models, when he does his statistical modeling of this, he treats the ideological commitment as a fixed parameter. That is, at least as I understand his models, he does not attempt to track over time changes in the degree of ideological commitment to the party. He just treats that as something that's fixed. The only thing that varies over time in his analysis is the nature of the class structure, what the actual distributions of people are, and the strategies of the party. One could, I think, imagine a way of modeling this, a more complicated model, in which you also model the cultural, ideological robustness of the party. But I'm not sure. I have no proposal for how you could do it, but one might imagine that it's doable. But then he looks at a number of historical instances and sees that the actual vote for socialist parties contesting parliamentary elections, whether the actual vote falls between these bounds, between the boundary that he estimates would be the vote maximizing boundary, that's the upper limit of what a party can win, and the boundary that is the working class purity boundary. And his models, roughly speaking, are consistent with this perspective. That is, the vote for, I think he looks at the Swedish Social Democratic Party and the German Socialists up to 1933. And in both cases, the votes do change, and the votes for the parties move from the lower to the upper bound in a way that's consistent with the historical accounts of their changing strategies, you know, the kinds of policies and platforms that the parties advocated. He also has some extremely interesting and provocative ideas in these models. At least some models that I've seen of his on this period shows that the room to maneuver of the German Social Democratic Party gets narrower. Those Gramsci bounds get narrower over time as you approach the early 30s. I mean, that's a... I have not interrogated his models well enough to know if that's a real result or some kind of contrived result. You know, you can't trust... These sorts of things get quite complicated because they involve computer simulations as well as statistical modeling. This is not straightforward analysis. Let's assume that it's all correctly done and there's no deep meta-theoretical problem in the mechanics of it. But what that suggests is that you could model the extent to which the strategic room to maneuver of parties declines, and they really do get boxed in to a point where they don't have strategic choice. It's not just that there are trade-offs, that they're basically forced into a given strategy because there's just no difference between what the upper and lower bounds of their possible strategies might be. He does not model in these the problem, which, and this is a flaw, of the competition between socialists and communists in his account. That is, a party to the left of the Social Democrats that actually also contests elections. That tremendously complicates his model. His model is very simple. It does enable him, I mean, his models do have this nice property that you could, if you fully did it, you could ask the question, what would the German Social Democrats have, what strategic options would they have faced if the boundaries on their strategies had been the same as the Swedish parties? You know, you could play counterfactual games. If you've modeled this very carefully, you could ask, what happens if you adopt the Swedish strategies but under the German constraints, or the German strategies but under the Swedish constraints? If any of you have a taste for, on the one hand, mathematical modeling and counterfactual history, then this is the kind of thing where there's the potential that you might be able to generate some genuinely new ideas. Okay, that's the second dilemma. Second dilemma, do we go to maximize votes? Do we stick with the working class party? Well, if you go for maximizing votes, then there's always the chance you might win an election. Indeed, the socialist parties that have won elections, with some interesting exceptions, not discussed in Szymborski's case, but there are some interesting cases where socialist parties win elections without trying to maximize their votes. They kind of win by accident. But mostly when socialist and social democratic parties win elections, they do so because they were trying to win the elections. And they were trying to win them by trying to maximize their votes, by attracting non-working class voters. Then they have the problem that they're in power, and they have to decide what they're going to do. And here comes then the third dilemma. The third dilemma of a socialist party. Again, we're not assuming that the people in the socialist party who get elected are dishonest manipulators who are just mouthing socialist rhetoric because they want to get elected, but actually they just have a lust for power. Now that could be the case as well, but Szymborski is, I think, taking the appropriate stance in thinking through these problems. Let's assume the best of them. Let's assume good faith on the part of the politicians. And what he shows is that even under those conditions, they're likely to behave in ways that will strengthen rather than weaken capitalism. The argument of the third dilemma then is the following. Once in power, the socialist government can do one of two things in a stylized way. They can engage in moves to challenge capitalism. They can try to pass through parliament nationalizations of heavy industry, redistribution of wealth, all the kinds of things that that would count as a serious transitional program within a democratic capitalist state to undermine the capitalist character of its economic structures and create the beginnings of a transition to socialism. That's one thing it can do. Or it can attempt to strengthen capitalism, make the capitalist economy more competitive, more robust, more stable, and within that context, engage in various kinds of programs that enhance the quality of life of workers, but in ways that are fully consistent with the reproduction and strengthening of capitalism. So that's the kind of reformist welfare state strategy that creates class compromises that strengthen capitalism, while at the same time improving the conditions of life of workers. Or they can engage in strategies which weaken capitalism. Now the third dilemma then is, if they do the anti-capitalist strategy, they will provoke capital flight and disinvestment and other disruptions which, in the short run, make the life of workers worse because unemployment rises and the general vitality of the capitalist economy declines more rapidly by virtue of that disruption. And therefore, they are likely to lose the next election. The third dilemma can be thought of as the next election problem. Unless the transition to socialism under a democratic socialist regime in a capitalist society is sufficiently rapid that the transition trough is shorter than the electoral cycle, the second election becomes a very major problem for any socialist elected government that attempts to transform capitalism through democratic means within the context of a parliamentary electoral democracy. So the Socialist Party then faces the choice. If we remain true to our platform and attempt to institute important elements of our program, of the anti-capitalist part of our program, we'll lose the next election. Be out. If, on the other hand, we deliver the goods and provide for better services and improve quality of life while strengthening capitalism, then we can win the next election. We'll stay in power and have a longer time horizon within which we can make changes. Yeah.
But what does the second option really mean? I mean, couldn't it also equally provoke disinvestment?
Well, the second option is a trickier one. It requires what I call positive class compromise, where the socialist government is able to solve problems for capitalism in such a way that it also benefits workers. It assumes that there's more than one equilibrium in capitalism. There's more than one way that capitalism can be robust. And one of the ways that capitalism can be robust is a way that also helps workers. If there's not two equilibria, if there's only one, then you're right. You know, if any redistribution, any public programs and public goods to help workers, and all of them have the character of making capitalism work less well and less efficiently, then you'll provoke disinvestment no matter what you do if it benefits workers. Although you might provoke it more if you do the full socialist program. The social democratic strategy that Szymborski models here claims that there are solutions, there are strategies that socialist parties can engage in that simultaneously strengthen capitalism and help workers. There are, to use a different kind of language, win-win solutions, or what I call positive class compromises. The classic example of that are Keynesian demand management. Keynesian policies which create full employment are good for capitalists because it guarantees more market stability and a greater market for their products. And it's also good for workers because it implies stable employment and longer time horizons, less insecurity. The Keynesian solution requires a lot of cooperation from workers as well as capitalists. That's why it is a positive class compromise. The Keynesian solution faces a number of problems which can undercut it. So, for example, one of the problems with Keynesianism, by Keynesianism I'm meaning in the standard sense, it's government policy where the government engaged in collective spending on public goods in order to increase aggregate demand. The content of the public goods doesn't matter from a Keynesian point of view. The Social Democratic Party in power can have the content of those public goods being a content that helps ordinary people in various ways. The problem with Keynesian policies is it creates very tight labor markets, which can push up wages, which is bad for capitalists. So Keynesian policies, in order to be stable over time, require wage restraint, require mechanisms that prevent wages from rising too rapidly. Wages need to rise no more rapidly than productivity under a Keynesian solution in order for it to be stable. And that requires cooperation by the working class. Workers have to be on board with the social democratic model in order for wages to be restrained. It also requires the state to be able to discipline individual capitalists, because individual capitalists, this is a kind of ironic point, individual capitalists want to raise wages in tight labor markets. And so we think of capitalists always wanting to keep wages as low as possible. It's not true. In a tight labor market, individual capitalists are desperate to raise wages. And that's because it's the only way they can get workers to fill empty positions, which they'd like to fill because you've got a booming economy, you've got a tight labor market, you want to produce more, but you can't because you can't hire more workers. And that's because there's not much unemployment. What do? Then you try to steal workers from other employers. How do you steal a worker? You offer higher wages. Now, workers have to be disciplined to refuse higher wages in a tight labor market if you want a stable Keynesian class compromise. Right? Now, that's a pretty delicate game you're playing. It requires a strong state. That is not going to happen under a decentralized, fragmented, non-regulative context. You need a strong state that's basically going to dampen competition by regulating labor markets and by preventing capitalists from poaching in various ways. That can happen. I mean, we have 40 or 50 years of that kind of positive class compromise in some countries. So it's possible, but it's difficult. Anyway, Chomorsky is saying that's the one option, is to do that, which is actually good for the lives of workers, but it doesn't do much to push you towards socialism, or you can engage in the socialist strategy and then lose the next election. In the end, then, what happens is committed socialists decide to participate in elections rather than be marginalized. Then they decide to engage in a strategy of alliances to win elections rather than to always lose elections. And then when they win elections, they decide to stabilize capitalism rather than oppose it because they want to win another election. And that's how, in the end, democratic institutions, even with committed socialist parties in the political arena, end up stabilizing rather than undermining capitalism. And there, I did keep it to the first half of the class. So I think what we should do, let's take a short break. When we reconvene, let's break down into, let's see, we're about 20, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 17, 18, 19, 21. So we're 20, let's break down into four groups of five people. Does five-ish sound right? We can either count off and have the venues done, or we can do it just by people. I think random is still best. It avoids the playground problem. This is familiar to all of our non-US citizens, students, but there's this classic American way that sports teams get picked, where you've got the two best athletes in whatever thing you're going to do are on opposite sides, and then they take turns picking from the other kids around. And you can see the last kid picked is pretty miserable. So we'll avoid such trauma by just counting off 1, 2, 3, 4.
1, 2, 3, 4.
1, 2, 3, 4.
1, 2, 3, 4.
1, 2, 3, 4.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Okay, and since there's one more one. And there are anybody else? The ones can be over on the couches. So I have 1, 2, 3, and 4. Okay, two sort of over here, 3 in that place, and 4 back there. It's 11. Let's reconvene by. Realistically, it's 10 after. We try to do it, it never happens. So at 10 after, reconvene, and then we'll discuss for 25 minutes. Small loops, and then at 25 minutes, you're going to be.
Thank you.
It should be in the next.
This is your paper.
You don't want to restrain them. You don't want stagnant
wages. Oh, I kind of need it, underlining and stuff, that's why. So, I read like this. It's not because I'm underlining. It's basically I read like underlining stuff.
And it actually does work.
This means that I've read this. I put these kind of things everywhere. And I put, maybe Pina might want to comment. I don't know. Very helpful. That was
okay. Thank you.
It was a little bit late, but Wednesday.
We went out to a couple parts. She's down there to teach for America.
It is true that if you have free capital mobility, you need capital. But until the last it's only in the last 30 years that maybe I many bad things in neoliberalism. But that's not inherent to capitalism.